NPR News.
President Obama's re-election bid takes him to yet another Democratic National Committee event this hour in San Francisco. It's part of a three-day trip in the western U.S. where he's looking to broaden support for his domestic and foreign policies. After San Francisco, the president holds a town hall meeting in Reno, Nevada, before heading back to California for another DNC event tonight in Los Angeles. Unemployment claims are down from their sharp rise a week earlier. The number of filers dropped by 13,000 to a seasonally adjusted 403,000. Stocks are turning higher after stronger earnings reports today from Apple, General Electric, and United Health Group. They all beat analysts' expectations. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from the Melville Charitable Trust, supporting solutions to prevent and end homelessness, on the web at melvilletrust.org.
Photojournalist Greg Marinovich and Joao Silva were filming the Civil War in South Africa when they became known as part of the Bang Bang Club. Their memoir has been adapted into a new film. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with them about combat photography. Marinovich was shot and wounded four times. Silva lost his legs in a landmine explosion in Afghanistan last fall. Join us.
This afternoon at 1 and this evening at 7 on AM 580.
Support comes from Community Shares of Illinois with the 8th Annual Share a Meal on Tuesday, April 26th. Participating restaurants donate a portion of their proceeds to Community Shares to help feed the hungry, house the homeless, protect civil liberties, and more. Urbana restaurants are Milo's and Black Dog Smoke and Ale House. A full list is at share-a-meal.org.
This is Focus, our morning talk program. It's hour two of the show. I'm David Inge. Harriet Williamson is our producer. The following program comes from the Focus Archive, so that means that for the next hour, we will not be taking your calls.
Through the course of a working weekday here on WILL, you'll hear how commodity futures, wheat, corn, beans, cattle, crude, and more are faring. How do these markets work? What's their history? In this hour of Focus, we go inside the Chicago Board of Trade and the Chicago Mercantile Exchange with journalist Emily Lambert. She is the author of The Futures, The Rise of the Speculator and the Origins of the World's Biggest Markets. Emily Lambert is a senior writer for Forbes. She covers finance and trading. She's also written for The New York Post. She lives in Chicago. 333-9455, 800-222-9455. The email address, will-talk@illinois.edu. Emily Lambert, good morning.
Good morning.
Nice to talk with you.
Thanks for having me.
Well, you point out that the concept of future contracts is really very old, but you say it really took hold in Chicago. Why?
Why is because, well, the fun way to describe it is that the weather in Chicago was really horrible. And so futures contracts developed in part because of that. But I think that a lot of perhaps your listeners are aware of why they developed, which is that the people who were raising crops in and around Chicago needed to get them to the city in order to sell them and had a time lag in doing so, and they wanted to be able to lock in prices. And that's why futures contracts developed, to give both the buyers and the sellers a way to lock in prices and not have to worry that the price of grain was going to suddenly change on them.
Hmm. Now, some might see futures traders as gamblers, as speculators, but you argue that they're different. How?
Well, I will tip my hat several times to people who say that they are gamblers, because in fact the earliest speculators, some of them were gamblers. They these developed around the time of the Civil War. There were, for whatever reasons, gamblers coming to Chicago. A lot of people were seeking opportunities, seeking ways to make money, to get rich, and ending up in Chicago. So some of those people did end up in the futures market. The point that I try to make in the book is that they ended up serving an actual economic function, even if some of those people were just as happy playing cards. When they traded futures, they were physically taking on a risk from a party that didn't want that price risk. So by using the futures contract, they ended up serving an economic function, and they have continued to do so. I mean, there's often talk about speculators doing this or that and being bad for the markets and bad for the economy. I think that speculation is not a very bad thing. Manipulation, when they manipulate the market, clearly that's not a good thing. But if the speculator is taking risks, then I tend to see it as a good thing.
Yeah. Well, this was not to say that all these folks through the history of this story have been angels, nor are they all angels today by a long shot. On page 8, you list some complaints that a fellow by the name of R.K. Slauson made in 1878 in a farm journal.
Oh, isn't that wonderful? I found that in the Chicago History Museum. And I have, it's a very long letter that he wrote into this farm journal complaining about the men at the Board of Trade, at the Chicago Board of Trade at the time where the futures market was, and how the various ways that they were hurting farmers and extracting their money. And he's very, very eloquent when he says this. He says all kinds of wonderful things about them. And by wonderful, I'm being a bit sarcastic there. But he goes on and on, and they were not just at that time manipulating the prices, but they were also the participants in the markets managed the railroads, they managed the grain elevators, they were able to cheat farmers in a variety of ways, but he really directed his ire at the futures market in particular, and I think that really has become kind of the focal point for the entire industry. So when something is wrong with the price, people look at the futures market.
Mm. He called them, among other things, bifurcated abominations in the sight of the Lord, brotherhood banditti, and members of a filching machine. Like cannibal insects, they do not hesitate to eat each other up. Also, they are banded together, and that they, too, under the eyes of the law, to rob farmers and country buyers, and their machinery is so simple and yet so perfect that success is theirs.
Yes, and that he had some legitimate gripes about the way that the market was operating at that time, and also at that time there were far fewer regulations on the market, both self-regulations and government regulations. And when those came to bear, that of course brought a modicum of control to the control might be the wrong word, but you know, some control to the marketplace. And it's very interesting also that the very concept of government regulation of private enterprise, period, in the entire country, originates with the early regulation of the futures markets. It was because they were so wild and woolly in those early days that at one point the government stepped in and said, you know what, you are private enterprise, but we are going to step in and make sure that this is running more responsibly. So the development of futures really has an enormous effect over the development of business in general in this country.
Yeah. Today, so much is traded in futures. We have trade in financial futures, trade in vital things like currencies and oil. How did that begin? How did the trade in options on stocks begin?
The trade on options on stocks began in the 70s. And in fact, a lot of what you're discussing there was really transformational, and it started in the 1970s. So from the 1860s through the 1960s, futures were solely agricultural on grains, on eggs, on foodstuffs in general. And then in the 1970s, really in the 60s, the markets got slow, and the traders in Chicago started looking for alternatives to create new markets, to create something that would keep them busy and, of course, make them some money. And the concept of stock options grew out of that. It was the grain traders at the Chicago Board of Trade looking for something else to do, and they came up with this idea of stock options. Meanwhile, down the street, there was a smaller exchange at that time, the Chicago Mercantile Exchange, and they came up with it's arguable whether it was actually their idea, but they certainly pioneered the concept of futures on currencies. And it really, from there, the concept of futures on financial instruments it turned into a really large industry that, in fact, dwarfs the amount of money that's in futures on commodities.
Mm. Well, these things are really vital. Are they in good hands?
Are they in good hands? That's a very difficult question. I think that my instinct is to say, yes, they are in good hands. That said, I think that futures are a very powerful tool, just like a knife is a very powerful tool, and it can be used well and responsibly, and it can be used irresponsibly, and futures are the same way. For futures' entire history until a couple of years ago, the exchanges were nonprofit institutions. They were member-run clubs. And I think that the members, for the most part, did a pretty good job of policing themselves. And I am not going to say they did a perfect job, but they did a pretty good job. In the last couple of years, these exchanges have gone public, and they are now for-profit institutions. And I think it would be too early, certainly, for me to judge whether they are in good hands and they're doing a great job. My instinct is to say they are, but this is a whole new era for markets we're in now, and it's a whole new ball game, and it's something that I think will require lots of further study.
Yeah. The board and the Merck have been consolidated under the CME group. Has that changed the business?
That has changed the business entirely. I mean, it's not just the CME group. All exchanges now are public. We've seen just in the last couple of days that the New York Stock Exchange is part of a public company. It's being purchased by another public company. The actual markets themselves continue to operate somewhat independently, but by virtue of being public companies, everything is different. I should amend that. It's not that everything is different, but there are changes that at this time it might even be too early to tell what they are.
Mm. Today, most of the trade is electronic. There's no more eyeball to eyeball. Well, there still is, but not like there used to be. How has that changed the business?
Well, it's made the business much faster, certainly, because when trades are done electronically, they're done much faster. It's made it, in a sense, much cheaper. If it used to be that if you wanted to, say, buy or sell a futures contract, or very frequently, as farmers I know use options contracts, they would call a broker. A broker would charge them a hefty fee in order to access that market. In a lot of ways, for some people, it's become cheaper to access the markets, and it also has made it much easier for people all around the world to access the markets, and as a result, volumes have grown. So it means that there are just many more traders trading much more quickly, and ultimately, transaction costs are down.
What kind of activity happens on the floors today?
On the floors, there are still pits where traders still meet. Some of those pits are nearly empty, and some of them are still pretty active. So you still have the traders in Chicago who go in every day, especially for the S&P pit. And for whatever reasons, the agricultural pits, I believe, have maintained I wouldn't say they are what they were, but a healthy population of people who still go in and trade hand-to-hand, eyeball-to-eyeball, like they did in the 1800s.
Mm. Thinking of a trader who did eyeball-to-eyeball and who also was instrumental in the trade in options on stocks, Eddie O'Connor. Would you tell us about him?
Eddie O'Connor was from an Irish family here in Chicago on the west side. He fought in the war. He came back. He became an insurance adjuster, and he made his way down to the Board of Trade because his brother had worked as a clerk there and because his cousin was a broker there. And he became a grain trader and worked his way up and became a very, very large grain trader at the Board of Trade. And he ran a clearing firm, so he sponsored quite a lot of other traders over the years. He also, you asked about stock options before. He mm-hmm. was with, it wasn't him alone, there were a group of traders, but he was very instrumental in getting the stock options exchange off the ground. Today it's the Chicago Board Options Exchange. And in a way, he really is a perfect mirror of the industry, because once he did that, he founded a firm that did electronic trading. We hear a lot these days about electronic trading and especially about high-frequency trading. His firm, which he had with his brother, was really at the forefront of that. It was called O'Connor and Company. I'm forgetting at the moment. But he died just a couple of weeks ago. He read the book before he passed away, which I was happy to hear, and I heard from his family that he really enjoyed it, and that meant a lot to me. But the I'm losing my train of thought now, but I'm thinking about him. He
spans the whole history in a way.
He really does. He spans the whole history. And there was something that was very interesting to me, because I went to his funeral and I was listening to one of his friends speak. And he really is a seminal figure in the history of the Board of Trade. But it was a friend of his who was not a trader who got up and talked about him and said, you know, we were out playing golf when I first met him. And I said, what do you do for a living? And he said, so only I manage risk. And I think that at best, that is what the futures traders and the futures contracts are there to do, to take risk from people who really don't want it, as we discussed at the very start. And I thought that was very interesting, because now a lot of people, I don't know if they when they trade futures, they think about it in that fundamental way that Eddie O'Connor did. And I think that he in a lot of ways kind of exemplifies what the market is at its best. Mm.
It seems his real passion was the soybean pit. Why?
When he first started, soybeans were the exciting market. When you are a speculator, which is what he was, then you are looking for a market that's active and that is moving, and it gives you an opportunity to make money. You can lose money also, but you want that opportunity to make money, and you can only do it when the price is moving. So at the time, there were other markets, but they were much more staid. Not to mention the fact that the people in those pits had been there a long time, and they had their own community and perhaps were more reluctant to give someone new a shot. But the soybean pit at that time when he entered, and this was the 1950s, was active, and it was the newest, one of the newer pits. And so that's, I believe, where and why he gravitated there. And that's where he made a lot of his money at the start.
When was the soybean pit added?
I want to say it was added in 1936. There was the soybean pit, and then soon after, or a couple of years after, maybe even more than a decade after, there was the soybean meal pit and the soybean oil pit.
Mm-hmm.
Excuse me. But I'm pretty sure that data is sticking in my mind for a reason. So I think it was 1936.
I think I recall now reading that it was the 30s. So, and you, I liked your metaphor of the pits. The soybean pit was the Maserati,
mm-hmm.
the corn pit, the Ford, and the wheat pit, the Cadillac. So I'm guessing corn came first, followed by wheat, and then beans.
You know, I corn and wheat were both there very early on, right. So I'm not sure exactly which came first. But it's true, and that gets back to you want the market to zoom on you. So the corn pit was not a zoomer at that time. The wheat wasn't either, but the soybean pit was going to zoom up and down. And for traders, that's exciting, and that's what they want.
Mm. Tell us a little bit more about Eddie O'Connor and how he went about managing risk. What kind of information was he on the lookout for? How did he gather his facts? How did he know what was, you know, how did he, you know, manage risk? He didn't know exactly what would happen, but, you know, he could take a good guess at it.
Right. Well, I think he managed risk in a way that probably a lot of farmers do today. A couple of years ago, I went on the crop tour, where farmers drive through several states and are looking at the corn, and you know, we broke off ears and counted to see, to estimate what the yield was going to be. He did that too. He and his brother would go down to your area, and visit local farms, and they also went to the Staley plants, and they, you know, they got to very familiar with the soybean crop, and would essentially place their bets, although he specifically told me not to use the word bet when discussing the futures market, but essentially they would place their bets on how big that the yield was going to be. And, you know, I visited his neighborhood and I drove by the house where he grew up, and it's a very city, urban neighborhood, and I thought it was very interesting that this city boy who grew up on the west side became so fascinated by soybeans. In fact, he was from this Irish family. His parents had both immigrated, and I believe he said that his father had been born a farmer. So he was only one generation removed there from farming. But it still remains kind of funny to me that he became so interested in soybeans. And he always was a bull also on beans from the 50s until he died, not always every second, but I think in general he always believed that the bean crop was going up.
Yeah. This is Focus. This morning our guest in this portion of the program is journalist Emily Lambert. She is the author of The Futures, The Rise of the Speculator and the Origins of the World Biggest Markets. We're talking today, in essence, about the history of the Chicago Board of Trade and the Chicago Mercantile Exchange. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this morning with a phone call or by email. We look forward to hearing your questions and comments. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. The toll-free number, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. And our email address is will-talk@illinois.edu. Going back to the history that you tell, would you share the story about Benjamin Hutchison and the coroner and burying the corpse?
Yes. So Benjamin Hutchison was really, he was called the first speculator, but he was really the first big manipulator of the market. So this goes back to the 1800s. He was a man who came from, and they called him Old Hutch, by the way. He came from Massachusetts. He was born on a farm. He didn't really like farming. I think he was in the shoe business for a while. He went to business, essentially. And he made his way to Chicago when Chicago was the boom town that it was in those days. He went into the meatpacking business and was one of the first to set up in what was then the brand new Chicago Stockyards on the south side of the city. In fact, south of the city at that time. And he also made his way to the Chicago Board of Trade, and he started trading in the grain pit. And he became someone who would corner the market. So he would do it also with groups, but he cornered the market. And he, by doing so, of course, you drive the price up. You can make all kinds of money. And then you have to somehow get rid of the contracts. The price will plummet back down. It's interesting, he made a lot of money at that time by cornering the market, but ultimately he lost all that money. Because if you don't successfully corner the market, then you get yourself in a really tight spot. And that's what happened to him. And then he disappeared and he left all his debts. His son had to kind of clean up a lot of his mess. He ended up in New York, trading in New York. And he was just a really fascinating character. I found there's an old book that was written about him back when he was famous. And it was in the rare book room of the Chicago Public Library, and it was one of those books that comes out and it has to be placed on a pillow, and you have to be very careful about when you're turning the pages. But he was such a fascinating character, and interesting to me that that the whole world doesn't know about him, but instrumental at the time.
You know, I think when we think of traders and speculators, we think of the amounts of money that can be made and lost. But it was interesting to me to learn that a lot of people in this business simply make a living, and that a lot of these folks had another job.
Especially at the start, yes, that's true. I mean, with Eddie O'Connor, who you mentioned, he worked as an insurance adjuster for quite a while trading. A lot of people, they were taxicab drivers while trading. Also, that was possible because trading hours, especially in the traditional commodities, were generally short trading hours. Some women who I know, the very few women who went down to the floor, did it because it allowed them to go home and get their kids from school, to work in the morning and yet to be home. So it was a job for a lot of people where it was possible to do that. My other favorite example of this is that the Chicago Mercantile Exchange, when it was growing at one point, it moved into a building right over Union Station where the trains are, and train conductors started working on the floor because they could take the trains in, drive the trains in the morning, and then they had hours before they had to drive the trains back out at night, so they would come up and work on the floor. And yes, some people made huge amounts of money, and some people lost equally huge amounts of money, but then there are some people who did make a living.
Tell us about the few women who have been in this game, especially earlier on.
These were men's clubs, without a doubt, and formally men's clubs until the 1960s. The very first woman who joined, the Chicago Merc had a woman there before the Chicago Board of Trade, which is generally the more staid institution. And the Chicago Mercantile Exchange's first woman member was actually a woman in Omaha, and she never traded on the floor, but she called in trades. After that, there were some women who just started working on the floor who must have had to put up with quite a lot sometimes from the men. And the first woman at the Chicago Board of Trade, I believe it was 1968 when she joined, and the membership had to vote and allow it, and it was really a big deal. Traditionally, even after there were some women, it remained a very male-dominated career. And I think even today, I know far more men who are in the business than I know women, although there have been some extremely successful women on the floor. But one thing I found very interesting is I talked to someone who did quite a lot of education for the Chicago Board of Trade over the years. And he said that when they were out teaching people about how to use the futures markets and why they might want to use the futures markets, he did an awful lot of teaching to farmers' wives, because he said that farmers, the men were often out in the field, and the women were managing a lot of the financial decisions. And so a lot of the farmers' wives were people who helped the futures markets grow.
Let's take a call now. This is Focus. Our guest this morning is journalist Emily Lambert, author of The Futures, The Rise of the Speculator, and The Origins of the World's Biggest Markets. This listener is in Champaign County on line one. Good morning.
Hi, good morning. It's mainly a historical document you're working on, but I assume you go up to the late days of the Clinton administration when that forgettable senator from Texas got through the futures modernization. I forget what it was actually called.
The Commodity Futures Modernization Act.
Yeah, and this is what unleashed it on the world, I guess. And I'm wondering a couple of things about that. Some of that started in Chicago, but since it's completely out of regulation and there's no exchange on it, unless I missed that, that was talked about as having some kind of exchange for these instruments, the more peculiar ones, and CDOs and futures and derivatives and all that stuff. How much of that actually was handled through Chicago, and how much of it still is? I don't think they may have been on the ground floor, but I think the elevator's gone up since then, and we don't actually know. We know roughly, how many trillions of dollars, hundreds of trillions of dollars are tied up in this and how much goes. But can you talk about that end of things?
Yes, and that's really an excellent question. They do give a total number for the size of that market. You're talking about the over-the-counter derivatives trade, and last I heard, it was $500 trillion. So it's huge, and it's much bigger than the futures market itself. And yes, what I think happened, and what I wrote happened, is that this derivatives market, when futures were created in the 1800s, they were just futures. There was no such thing as derivatives. But when, in the 1970s, Eddie O'Connor and some of the other traders in Chicago started coming up with these new futures contracts, it blossomed into something else. What Eddie O'Connor created was options, and then you had financial futures, and then you had commodity futures. And so they started calling these things in total derivatives. And then eventually what you're discussing happened, the Commodity Futures Modernization Act. I think the really deciding point even came earlier. It was in the 1980s that when the futures traders got into this, to the financial business, they butted heads with essentially Wall Street, who was already in the financial business, and Wall Street started to get very interested in the futures trade, and they started trading futures, and they also started creating their own versions of derivatives. And then there was really a deciding moment where the folks in futures said, hey, what you're trading over there are futures contracts, just like we trade here, and we have to follow all kinds of rules, because back in the 1800s, we traded them wild and woolly, and then there developed regulation for these markets. And you were essentially back in the 1800s right now, trading futures, but with no regulation. And so they went to the Commodity Futures Trading Commission, which is the regulatory board that had been created, and essentially made this appeal. And the folks in Wall Street said, these aren't futures. These are swaps. These are customized. These are different. And we are sophisticated traders, unlike the guys who started in Chicago. And we don't need that same kind of regulation. And the CFTC at that point decided to agree, and that was really reinforced with the decision that you're referring to, the Commodity Futures Modernization Act, which essentially said these look like futures, but they're not futures, and they don't have to follow the same rules. And that's why they really developed two distinct derivatives markets, which I think a lot of people don't necessarily understand. There are the regulated derivatives markets and futures, and then there's this huge unregulated derivatives market called over-the-counter derivatives. And it's interesting to note that the financial crisis came out of those unregulated derivatives, and what the Dodd-Frank Act has done, the financial reform bill has done, is it's trying to impose a lot of the futures rules on that unregulated market.
But that's still yet to be implemented.
And it's been 2 years, so you would think that they might get around to that.
Phil Graham is the senator I was thinking of. Do you also do a little portrait of the woman who was arguing against this very vigorous? She has a waspish last name. I can't remember her right now. But.
I'm not sure who you are. Are you talking about Brooksley Bourne?
Yeah, exactly.
Mm-hmm. Well, see, when I was writing the book, my argument was really that a lot of that, the path to that, was I mention her, but I say that the really deciding point was in the 80s, which was before she came along. So I think that by the time Brooksley Bourne came on the scene and started pointing out exactly what you're saying, that the precedent had already been set.
But it didn't actually start in Chicago. It was down Wall Street way that all these things were created. And
right, but it was really, in my opinion, and people on Wall Street have argued vigorously against this and said, no, we created these separately. I think they learned quite a bit of that from Chicago and looking at the futures contracts and learning about the futures market.
Yeah, I wouldn't call it blossom, though. I'd say metastasize is more what I mean.
That may be the right word.
Thanks a lot. Bye.
Thanks for the call this morning. I know there is at least one trader in your book from New York who went to Chicago and was a student of the Chicago, how it worked in Chicago, and then he took that back to New York.
And there was more than
there,
one.
More than one, okay.
Yeah, there really was quite a lot of back and forth, and there's, I'm not sure who you're referring to. I mentioned in the mortgage markets, I think I mentioned some folks on Wall Street by name. John Merriweather was at Solomon Brothers. He started using futures on mortgage contracts. But there really was quite a bit of cross-pollination when there was a trader who I mentioned, a very colorful trader named Jim Place, who was a New Yorker. His parents moved to Chicago. His dad worked in the futures business for Merrill Lynch. They moved back to New York. Jim ended up back in Chicago and became a trader here. There was quite a bit of back and forth.
The recent proposals for regulating OTC derivatives, where do they stand?
They are, right now, they have tasked the Securities and Exchange Commission and the Commodity Futures Trading Commission with doing quite a lot of work to basically implement a lot of what Congress wants to have done. So right now, the proposals and the changes are with the regulatory agencies, and they're supposed to be done, I think, by July. And they are saying that they are very underfunded, and they, you know, are passing rules left and right and just trying to get this out. But that's where it is. Right now, all the decisions are with the regulatory agencies.
And how do traders feel about what's coming?
Well, which traders? The futures traders, for the most part, I think, tend to see that as a good thing, because they would be of the mind that reining in those the less regulated markets is a good thing. Of course, the traders who trade the over-the-counter derivatives tend to see it as a very bad thing, and it's going to hurt their profitability.
There's a lot of detail in this book, but you tell the story very well. It's it really moves along.
Thank you.
What led you to this story? And you mentioned the Historical Society or in Chicago. What else were some of your sources?
Well, what led me to the book was that I moved to Chicago in 2004, and I just started meeting traders all over the city. And also, the Chicago Board of Trade building is downtown. It's a very imposing, beautiful building, and I was just curious as to what happened in there. It really is. It's just such a big and interesting industry in the city, and the people seem very interesting. And so that's how I started to get curious and learn more. The book ultimately happened because I wrote a cover story for Forbes about the CME and the Board of Trade when they merged, and that attracted some interest, and then it gave me the ability to write the book. You had another question there.
Your sources for information.
I used quite a lot of the materials at the Chicago Public Library, in the rare books collection, the microfilm. Read a lot of old newspaper articles from the 1830s forward. I went to the Chicago History Museum. I used just basically all the old resources I could get my hands on. That said, overwhelmingly, the stories that I put in and the information that I have there come from traders. I talked to a lot of the older traders. Eddie O'Connor is one. I was very, very. I feel very privileged to have caught him while I did. I talked to some of the old egg traders, because a lot of the Chicago Mercantile Exchange started as a butter and egg board. So the old egg traders who are still around, and really tried to. There's this group of people in Chicago who lived through this story, and I think it's, for whatever reason, it hasn't gotten out beyond that community. And so that's what I based most of the information on, was solely interviews with these traders. And I talked to lots and lots of them. In the book, I think I talked to 100 traders, but that's because I was too lazy to go back and actually count up the number of traders who I interviewed. I mean, I interviewed lots and lots of traders.
Let's take another couple of telephone calls. Next, we go to someone in Bloomington on line 4. Hi.
Hello. Just a couple points. The old standby contract was the pork bellies contract, but that and the hog futures is basically going away because it's not needed anymore, because now the Packers own the hogs from day one. So I don't know if the whole hog contract is going to eventually disappear. And then another point, these arbitrage trades that are, what, just thousands of trades a minute by a computer that are trying to take advantage of small price differences and very small margins per trade. During the last campaign, the Green candidate suggested that we tax these trades, and I actually think that is a great idea. I trade a few contracts, and that wouldn't be that big a cost, but for some of these guys that just trade thousands of trades a minute, I think that'd be a good step.
Well, the first about hogs and pork bellies, you're right that those contracts are dying. Pork bellies is a really fascinating contract because pork bellies, in a sense, you might say that we wouldn't have the massive derivatives markets that we have today if it wasn't for the pork belly contract. The Chicago Merc was about to die at one point because its main contract had withered away, those being butter and eggs. Its other contract was onions. They managed to manipulate that one into oblivion, and they had nothing to trade, so they came up with pork bellies, and pork bellies were just an amazing hit and got people in. You know, movie stars started trading them, random cab drivers started trading them. Everyone was suddenly interested in pork bellies, and that is what kept the exchange alive, and that led them to decide to do all kinds of other innovations. So pork bellies in the history of derivatives is a really interesting contract. So it is very poignant now to see it kind of lose its reason for being, and frankly, as it should, either the contract needs to be changed to be relevant or it doesn't have a reason to exist. As for taxing all these high-frequency traders, I'm going to say I'm on the opposite side of your view when it comes to that, because I think that I don't necessarily see high-frequency traders as being necessarily a bad thing. I see they're bringing liquidity to the market. I do think that if there's too much trading, or that there's too much trading that's able to that's counterproductive, that's a problem. But what I wouldn't want to do is chase the good trading and the good liquidity out of the market. I know it's a highly controversial issue, and but like most everything in the market, it's one that gets incredibly political very fast.
Does the listener want to follow up?
Only one point. Do you think if they were taxed or regulated more, do you think there's really a possibility these markets could move overseas?
Well, that's a difficult question. I think that yes and no. I think that's something that the markets like to claim a lot in order to avoid further regulation. But I think if you look at what's happening even just this week with the New York Stock Exchange, you see that it's hard to move a market, and especially a futures market. It really is hard. Once people are kind of gathered in one place, it's like trying to move, I guess, I don't know, a large animal. You know, you have to. It's not easy to get it going. And I think it's getting more and more possible now that the markets are electronic for that to happen, for markets to move. But I wouldn't want to not pass needed regulation because we're worried about markets moving. I'm an optimist enough to hope that correct regulation can exist and that the markets would stay put as long as they have it.
I want to thank the listener for his call. We'll take another call now. A listener in Champaign on line one. Hi.
Hi. On the change from from nonprofit to profit, does it still exist in terms of a seat on the board?
Yes, there are still seats, but it used to be that when you had a seat on the board, you got two things. You had equity in the exchange itself.
Mm-hmm.
And you also had discounted members' rates for trading. So if you were someone who traded a lot, like the market maker on the floor used to do, or especially now like these high-frequency trading guys do because they trade so much, then you really benefit quite a lot by having members' rates. So if you have a seat now, you still get members' rates, but you no longer have ownership of the exchange itself because it is publicly traded. So if you want to own the exchange, you just go and you buy shares.
What was the what happened is I went to school with a fellow that actually at a young age got into, you know, the trading and actually bought one seat, and then his children got into it, and I think they were maybe bought a couple more seats.
Mm-hmm.
Way back then, it was $100,000 or so, but that price must have really went up, didn't it, or not?
Oh, yeah, it did. It's funny. Talking to people now who bought their seats for, you know, paid $5,000 in the 50s for a seat, those seats at one point were worth, I don't know how high they got up, but I think they might have gotten up to $1 million at one point. I mean, those were some incredibly good investments. In fact, even in 2005 or in 2004-05, when I moved here and before the Board of Trade had gone public, I remember someone telling me the best investment you can make right now is to buy a seat on the Board of Trade. And in fact, that proved to be a very good investment for anyone who had at that time a couple $100,000 to invest in a seat on the Board of Trade. But you mentioned you knew a trader and his whole family got into the business. That is very common here. Eddie O'Connor, who we've been talking about, his kids went into the business. His brother was in the business. There really are trading families here, and in fact, entire neighborhoods, they're just populated by traders. It really is an interesting culture, and it's in some senses, even though it's a humongous business, still a very family business.
So in terms of when they take a position, how is the money made then? Is it in terms of, you know, in other words, you know, the risk is high, you know, if they went up and the market goes up, they have to sell it before it comes down? Is that the idea? Or
mm-hmm. Yeah, but there are two ways that people have traditionally made money. The first is by being a broker and simply collecting a commission for helping people trade in the markets or for, you know.
What was what rate was there on that?
Oh, it changed over the years. Oh. I mean, at one point there was everybody charged the same thing. It might have been $35 a round turn, but then the rules were that they had to be competitive and the rates went down. So, but people, I mean, they made nice livings. They could make clear $1 million a year as a broker. They did just fine as brokers. But what you're referring to more is when actual speculators, right, are speculating the market. And yes, the goal, just like with the stock market, is for them to buy low and sell high, or because this is futures, you can also do the opposite and short the market to sell high and buy low. And nobody makes money on every single trade, but the goal was, of course, to have more winners than losers and at the end of the day, to have made money.
Okay, very good program.
Thank you for the call this morning. We're coming down here on time, and there are a lot of us who really don't know anything about this business at all. But, you know, we tune in to this radio station and others, and we might hear terms like short covering and bull spreading. Maybe you'd give us a thumbnail definition of one or both of those.
Oh, I couldn't even. Is it bull spreading? I'm not aware of. Spreading.
Spreading
I can do. But I would say when I first moved here, I remember sitting by the lake with a Trading for Dummies book and getting to a section that was about butterflies and iron condors and just being like, oh, my goodness, these guys must all be geniuses. I don't understand how they do this. And some young guy saw me reading and tapped me on the shoulder and said, you know, keep up at it. It's, you know, it's not that bad. And it really, this is ultimately kind of common sense stuff, even though it sounds very complicated. With spreading, it's a risk management thing that people do essentially to buy one contract, say a contract expiring, because futures contracts expire, unlike stocks. They're only good for a couple of months, or in the case of oil, a month, and then they expire. So you might buy one expiring in March and sell one expiring in June to kind of manage your risk. So that's what a, like, unless I'm I'm just going off the rails here. That's spreading. And yeah, but there are just millions of bizarre terms to describe what's going on.
Yeah.
It's essentially, of course, bull is going up, bear is going down. If you're bullish on the market is going up. If you're bearish on the market is going down.
Yeah. Well, I want to, we have to wrap up here pretty quickly. I want to thank you so much for talking with us this morning. Maybe you would tell us one real quick question about another colorful character in the history of these markets, Vincent Kosuga.
I was hoping you would ask him.
And it'll have to be quick, but he's the guy who was in the onion market.
He was in the onion market. He was just an amazing character. He carried a gun around. He was he knew the Pope, and he manipulated the onion market so much that Congress stepped in and banned futures on onions, which until recently was the only futures contract that had ever been banned by congressional mandate.
Mm. And there we'll leave it. Emily, thanks so much for joining us this morning.
Thanks for having me.
Emily Lambert is a senior writer for Forbes. She is the author of The Futures, The Rise of the Speculator, and The Origins of the World's Biggest Markets. The book is published by Basic Books.
You've been listening to a program from the Focus Archives. Much of our local production, including past interviews from Focus and local news features, is available on our website anytime that you're ready to listen. Just go to will.illinois.edu. I'm David Inge. Thanks for tuning in.
I'm Rebecca Bird. I bike to work from Champaign to my office at the City of Urbana.
And I'm Becky Roach. I bike to work from Champaign to the University of Illinois.
Bike to Work Day is coming May 3rd. CU Fit Families and WILL invite you to join your neighbors and bike to work on Tuesday, May 3rd. For more information, visit cubiketowork.com.
WILL programs are made possible by the Center for Advanced Study, whose MillerCom 2011 lecture series presents The Meaning of Ramanujan and His Lost Notebook by George E. Andrews on Thursday, April 26th at 4 p.m. at Knight Auditorium in the Spurlock Museum.
The thought of Donald Trump running for president may seem like a joke, but not to everyone.
If you go to New Hampshire, if you go to Iowa, and you talk to Republican primary voters, you'll be surprised how many people are taking him seriously.
Donald Trump's would-be candidacy. We'll take a closer look at what's behind the hype today on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Today from 4 to 7 on AM 580 and from 5 to 7 on FM 90.9.
It's a couple minutes before 12 noon on WILL. And the Afternoon Magazine is coming up. I'm Tom Rogers. I'll be the host in the next hour. We'll take a look at news, including World Have Your Say from the BBC, coming up in a few minutes, and AM 580 news at the bottom of the hour. Looking right now at the stock market, or the commodity markets, we see the wheat continuing to rise, as is the soybean market. Corn not rising as much, but still recovering a little bit from its 2% drop in the past couple of days. Bean futures are looking at fund buying and continued weakness in the dollar, and that's helping out the beans. Kansas City May wheat currently trading up 11 cents a bushel at 931. July up 10 and a quarter up at 941 a bushel. That's up 10 and a quarter cents. May wheat in Chicago is trading at 796 and three quarters. That's up 11 and three quarters. The July up 11 and three quarters as well at 832 and a half. In the corn pit, May is at 734 and a quarter right now. That's up 1.5 cents. July up a penny and three quarters, now 2 cents at 742 and a half. September at $7 even, up 2 3/4. December up 5 1/4 cents at 660 and three quarters. Crude oil keeps going up, up 45-46 cents a barrel now at 111.91. RBOB gasoline is at 328 and 4 tenths. That's up about 6 tenths of a penny. Soybeans for May coming up and right now at 1378 and a quarter. That's up 20 and a half cents a bushel. July at 1388, up 18 and three quarters. August up 16 and a half at 1387 and three quarters. September 1382, up 13 and a half cents. November up 12 at 1378. Bean meal for May is up a whopping 860 right now at 357.80. Bean oil is at 58.23, up 9. Livestock are down right now. April live cattle at 118.80, down 20. April feeder cattle at 132.27.5, down 42.5. And May lean hogs are at 102.10, down 80. Quick look at Wall Street, where the